It's my great pleasure to lead this virtual panel on open access. I'm Shinobu Kitayama. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and the current president of the APS. Throughout my career, I have studied cultural influences in cognitive, emotional, and motivational processes. The goal of this panel is to elucidate both opportunities and challenges of open access. Open access is an emerging model of journal publishing that has become increasingly prominent for various reasons. Instead of relying on journal subscriptions, this model charges the cost of publications to authors of the articles that are published. One potential issue that arises is the financial burden, quote unquote, placed on researchers who must pay the fee to publish their work. These fees are not trivial. Actually, they are quite substantial, reflecting the fact that it is quite costly to sustain high-quality journal publication operations. How expensive is it to publish in open access journals? Two of the most respected open access journals, Nature Communications and Science Advances, charge approximately $5,000. One of the most popular open access outlets, Frontiers in Psychology, now charges $3,000. At present, all APS journals are based on the traditional subscription-based model, but this may change in the future, and actually in the near future for one of our journals. Therefore, it is important for all of us to have a clear understanding of both opportunities and challenges of the open access model of journal publishing. This problem pertains directly to the financial basis of all academic societies, including the APS. The reason is that a substantial portion of operating budget of many such societies, including the APS, currently comes from our journals. I'm very, very pleased to have four outstanding panelists today. They are distinguished in their own ways. Furthermore, each of them has extensive experience in journal publishing. As important, the panelists are quite international. While the two of them are located in North America, the remaining two are in Europe and Australia. My intent is to assess the cross-national global landscape of open access. At the very outset, I want to express my gratitude for their willingness to participate in this panel. I would like to start off by having the panelists introduce themselves. Ayşe, could you start?
My name is Ayşe Üskül. I'm a professor of social psychology at the University of Kent in the United Kingdom. In my research, I have focused on cultural and socio-ecological influences on psychological processes related to how we define ourselves and how we relate to other individuals. Most recently, I've been working on the role of honor in different social interactional processes. I've also served as associate editor in Psychological Science and JPSB second section until recently.
Dan?
I am Dan Simons. I'm a professor at the University of Illinois in the United States. Most of my research focuses on visual perception and attention and awareness. And more recently, a bit on research practices. I'm currently the editor-in-chief at APS's journal AMPS, Advances in Methods and Practices in Psychological Science. And we're expecting to be going to an open access model in the next year for AMPS.
Susan.
My name is Susan Fisk. I teach at Princeton. I've joined appointments in the Department of Psychology and in the School of Public and International Affairs. My research area is social cognition, broadly defined. I focus very much on stereotyping and prejudice as one way that people make sense of each other. And my journal editing experience goes back a long way. Right now I'm editing for three journals, PNAS. I'm one of 250 editorial board members at that journal. I started a journal called PIBS, which is Policy Insights from Behavioral and Brain Sciences. And my longest tenure is at the Annual Review of Psychology. Oh, my open access experience, I'll talk about that with regard to the Annual Review.
Yoshi?
Yes, my name is Yoshi Kashima. I'm a professor of psychology at the University of Melbourne, Australia. My journal publishing experiences, I was the associate editor at the JPSB some years ago, and I was involved in two other journals, and one of them is the Asian Journal of Social Psychology. Probably that's the most direct experience I had about the managing a journal as a kind of like a publisher of the or the owner of the journal, and that gave me interesting sort of insights about the aspects of the journal publishing.
Thank you. So first off, open access is pretty new and not necessarily well known or well recognized in all regions of the globe. I want to start by asking the panelists how the open access has been received or recognized in their regions. Specifically, I want to ask each panelist what their perception or experience of open access might be, and how about their colleagues or their students and so on. Are their responses positive, negative, or mixed? And maybe you can mention why. Yoshi, would you like to start?
Yes, well, thank you, Shinobu. Maybe I'll relay my perceptions and impressions from Oceania, that is Australia and New Zealand, but also from Asia, because of my involvement in the Asian Association of Social Psychology. And probably it's fair to say that the Oceanian experience is probably similar to European one, and similar in many ways to North America. And the people have been expressing mixed opinions about it, and they are using open access to their advantage, I suppose. And luckily, we have been able to manage the financial burden for it, but the current COVID situation might change the financial situation a little bit. Speaking for the Asian colleagues, I think the experience is probably more on the negative side, and they are largely for the reason of the publishing burden. I mean, basically, they cannot, many of the colleagues express that they really can't afford $5,000 to publish a paper. I can certainly relate to that perspective. And so perhaps I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Aisha?
So I think the perception and experience of open access within the UK and more broadly in Europe would need to be discussed, considering the changing forces and policies within the funding bodies and higher education institutions. So I'd like to give a little bit of a brief overview of what has been happening in this region. So because that, you know, the overall climate has been shaping how we relate to this and how we think about it. So within the UK Research and Innovation introduced a collective policy on open access in 2013. As part of that, they have allocated funds for open access practices. So just between 2013 and 2017, they spent about £75 million to support open access activities that were primarily used to cover the article processing charges. And that has resulted in the number of open access articles doubling in number, reaching about 10,000 articles being supported through these funds just in 2017. So that gives you an idea. So an additional push came from the Research Excellence Framework, the REF. This is the UK's exercise for assessing research excellence in universities. And they now require research outputs to be made open access for those outputs to be eligible for submission in REF 2021. So this, of course, gave a huge momentum to institutions for adopting and supporting systems and tools developed to assist researchers in making their outputs open. Then at the European level, the UK Research and Innovation is part of Coalition S, which has agreed to pursue with Plan S, which states starting from 2021, all scholarly publications resulting from research funded by public and private grants must be published in open access journals, on open access platforms, or made immediately available through open access repositories. And there are several organizations that are part of Plan S, including national funders in countries such as Poland, the UK, Germany, Norway, and so on. regional funders such as the Horizon 2020 and charities such as the Wellcome Trust and World Health Organization. So at the moment, this is a very Europe-based movement, but the goal is to expand it as much as possible. So it is within these structural changes, I think we need to think about how we relate to open access within the UK and Europe. And I think a lot of us recognize the advantages of open access, such as widening dissemination of knowledge, encouraging collaboration, avoiding duplication efforts, speeding up innovation, and so on. However, there's also anxiety voiced, especially by early career researchers who are not so clear on how they can sustain publishing without having the support, the funds to support the process. And also, in addition, what publishing in open access journals would mean for their careers in terms of securing jobs and getting promoted and so on. So I think more broadly, researchers are worried, as you said, Shinobu, earlier, for the costs associated with open access publishing to be put on their own shoulders as individual researchers and having to deal with it, the increasing stress that would come with that. Currently, discussions in Europe, I think, involve which publishing models would work best in creating a future in publishing that is sustainable, secure, and inclusive, including models where neither the authors nor the readers incur any costs, as is the case currently, for example, with the journal Chemical Science, the flagship journal of Royal Society of Chemistry.
So, Aisha, let me ask you a very quick question. Is there any realistic blueprint for the future? I don't think all the funding from Wellcome Trust or many other private funding foundations or, you know, maybe EU may stop sometime, or you may not count on this for eternity. Or is there any prospect?
Well, I think from what I have read and heard, especially the Plan S, takes this very seriously, and they're going to hold the grant holders accountable, and they will monitor how they publish their work. And in 2024, I think the whole plan is going to be reassessed to see whether it's being implemented, what consequences it leads to. But at the moment, both the UK funding agencies, charities, as well as national research and innovation and so on, they seem to be very committed. But of course, all these plans have been put together before COVID, where, you know, there weren't many financial concerns, you know, in front of them as we're currently dealing with. But that seems to be being taken very seriously at the moment. So, but that is only through funding at the moment and through the REF, the Research Excellence Framework. So I think the structural changes and the policy changes are really forcing the researchers in the UK and Europe to think about open access very carefully and take it seriously. Okay. So for the short term, I think for the short term, there seems to be a very strong commitment.
Susan?
So what the business model is what has worried me from the outset, and particularly because I'm in a field in social psychology where many people manage to get their work done without grants. And we also have to think in the United States about people who teach at liberal arts colleges who may be less likely to have grants, but they still would like to publish. I actually, besides your grant paying for it, some universities are requiring people to post the preprint version. So that you can do, but if you want to get published, you still have to pay the page charges. So I've experienced with two experiments of business models to try to solve this. One experiment that is being considered concerns the Handbook of Social Psychology, which we're starting to organize again. And we're thinking about possibly publishing it ourselves. And you can't very well invite people to write a handbook chapter and then say, by the way, fork over $5,000 for the privilege, you know? So there, the sacrifice of time and effort would be the editors, maybe the authors to some extent, because they'd be expected to format their own papers more. But so that's one model, you know, where the editors and the authors donate time. You'd give up having a professional marketing organization, but that's one model for our journals and our edited volumes. Another one I think is more interesting in a way. So the Annual Reviews publisher is a nonprofit publisher, and they have about 50 different reviews across different fields. And the Annual Review of Psychology goes back to the early 50s, and it's a really successful journal. But the current editor-in-chief of the whole thing has an ethical commitment to open access. And he has invented an idea that I think is brilliant if it works, which is he's capitalizing on librarians' commitment to open access. In fact, librarians care a lot about open access, and they'd like to facilitate it. So what we do as an organization is approach libraries and say, we'll give you a 5% discount on your subscription if you donate it, your fees to an open access pool. And if the journal gets enough commitments to open access, it's called Subscribe to Open, then the annual reviews can afford to publish the journal and make it open. So they did this with Annual Review of Public Health at first, and the number of downloads went up by an order of magnitude. It was unbelievable, the spike in downloads and accesses. So it's enormously successful in increasing access, and this arrangement avoids the free rider program, which otherwise you would have, because if not enough librarians take the 5% discount and subscribe to open, then the journal goes back behind a paywall. So I'm watching this experiment and really hoping it works because, you know, in terms of inequality for authors, I think the author charges are a real problem.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. So Susan, I have one question about annual review. Right now, participating libraries are in the United States or everywhere?
Everywhere. So everybody can contribute to.
Oh, I see. So this whole operation was managed by annual review, I suppose.
Yes. But
this can be, in principle, can be expanded, correct?
Yeah. So it's a nonprofit publisher. So its motives are totally different.
Right, academic societies, including APS, are nonprofit, obviously. So I suppose, in principle, very similar to the situation where annual review is.
Yeah, so there's one problem that I haven't mentioned with this model, which is that some universities, particularly state universities, object to having their librarians donating the subscription fee to a nonprofit. They say, well, you know, why are you doing that? We'll just cut your budget if it's open access. But, so it has to be this contingent arrangement.
I see. Okay, next panelist is Dan.
So, you know, the response to open access, I think, has been mixed. There hasn't really been a single unified response, and there really couldn't be because open access isn't one thing. So some of the examples we've heard about are things like Nature Communications charging $5,000, but Annual Reviews is a nonprofit and is trying to work on a different model, right? And it's trying to work on a model that doesn't require those exorbitant charges directly from authors. And I think it's really important to distinguish between commercial publishers who really have a profit motive and nonprofits and societies that don't. Most societies partner with commercial publishers, and that's where they make most of their revenue. But the commercial publishers are making a lot of money off of academic publications. Right? Most of the major commercial publishers have approaching 30% profit margins. And it's interesting to think about sort of our publishing model. If we were to start from scratch and we had no publishing model, we didn't have any publishers, and we had to figure out what would you want to do from scratch, I doubt it would look anything like what we have, either in the closed system or the current open access models. And one way to think about that is, if you ask people just in the public, not researchers, not academics, most of them think that academics get paid for publishing in journals, because that's how every other publishing model in the world works. If you write a book, the publisher pays you for the content. If you write an op-ed for a newspaper, you get paid for it. So the model in which we're paying the publishers is kind of a strange model, since our research is funded for the most part by taxpayers, either through the universities or through federal grants. And then we're providing all of the labor and all of the content to the commercial publishers, who then limit access to it and then profit by selling it back to the libraries at exorbitant costs. So then the taxpayers are paying again if it's a public university. And then if they add on an open access charge on top of that, that's pure profit because they're making the subscription model and getting charges from authors. So it's a weird model to begin with, and it profits exclusively by limiting access. And I think that's partly why a lot of the reaction of the open access idea is to try and counter that, to try and not profit by limiting access, but make the charges coincide with making it more available. But that has complications too, right? So I think part of the reason that there's sometimes been a negative reaction to open access is it kind of harkens back to the older model pre the modern movement toward open access of pay to publish journals, which were essentially scam journals. You don't get any peer review, you don't have to go through an editorial process, you pay and it gets published. And some of those still exist. Predatory journals are pervasive and they're more common in the open access world because it's easier to do them, right? There's no production costs involved. So I think there's a conflation of that sort of predatory model with what most open access models are. And the positive reactions I've seen to open access have mostly not been the ones from the prestige journals, the commercial publishers like Nature Communications or Science Reports. It's been to the newer models that are based on university consortia, things like what Susan was talking about, getting libraries to pitch in to make a transition from subscription to open access, because the libraries hate having most of their budget go to massive costs for subscriptions and for subscription bundles where they have no choice but to pay for journals they don't actually want. The closed model also limits access. So when I was a liberal arts undergraduate, we had a small library. This was pre-internet, but we had no access. I mean, online searching had just started, and I was able to access, for a search on visual masking, I was able to access 3 articles out of the 120 that turned up in my search. That's still a problem. Small libraries don't have the resources to pay for massive subscription costs. It's a huge part of their budget. So there are costs regardless of which model you go from. Open access models make those costs a little bit more transparent. Instead of the libraries having to pay for it, the researchers are paying for it. And the question is there some way of transitioning to something that's more equitable for researchers who don't have resources? Most open access journals do have waiver policies, but if we could get the libraries to buy in, then you can actually make some substantial changes. That's what's happening with the sort of model that Susan was talking about. It's also what happened in the Netherlands, where you have a relatively smaller number of universities that can kind of team up. It's a problem in the United States, where you have such a huge number of universities with different funding models in public and private, getting them to be able to buy in. Sometimes they just can't. But that, I think that's the goal, is see if there's a way of eliminating these sorts of author-based charges to eventually get to the point where we're just shifting the profits away from the commercial publishing and to the payment for those costs of true costs of publishing.
Well, one, I don't know if I call it a problem. Mm-hmm. There are so many journals, and each one of us was surely here, you know, all of you guys published so many article, and our careers and our students' careers are based on, you know, basically papers that you publish. Mm-hmm. More often than not, a search committee will count the number of publications of job applicants. And well, my university claimed that you know, search committee members read those articles, but you know, it's very hard to claim that we ignore the number of articles listed on the CVs. Now, so that seems like a real, well, part of the problem, because there are so many journals. Dan refers to predatory journals. There are many of them, but of course, there are many enough consumers or, you know, people who are profiting from those journals. So seem to me that the solution to this whole problem requires really systemic change of whole academia. It's hard to tell exactly where to start. So earlier this year, we managed to get one of our papers accepted for publication in one of the top-notch open access journals, you know, Science Advances. But the invoice I received from the journal gave me a pause. It was a hefty $4,500. To me, this episode made me think deeply about both promises and the problems of open access. Naturally, in my presidential column, I'm discussing open access primarily as an alternative business model for journal publishing. Sometimes, however, open access is discussed in conjunction with open science. I now want to move on and discuss how we might conceptualize the link between open access and open science. So Susan, would you like to start?
Well, I think there are a lot of ways to answer this question. So let me take a devil's advocate position, which is that I think they're superficially similar because they both have the word open, but then that's the end of it. So I think one is about methods and statistics and reporting openly what you did and making it available to other people to replicate and so on. And the other one is whether people have access to the publications and who reads it. So I guess you could make an argument that they're overlapping because the more people who read your stuff, the more likely they are to challenge it and replicate it and so on. But I think it's, for me, the link is conceptually weak. I see it as quite different. Maybe it's part of the same rebellion against the old ways of doing things. Anyway, so that's my devil's advocate stance.
Oh, Dan, how to address Susan's question?
I would agree. I think they are often linked, but they don't have to be, right? I mean, the open science movement is about being transparent about what you've done. So if there's any common link, it's transparency, that if you're publishing open access, you have more possibilities of, say, linking your materials, making things more available. It makes it easier for people to find the articles in the first place. So in that sense, it makes it more transparent. It's easier to link to contents from an open access journal. So for example, if you have all of your materials available, unless in a subscription journal, unless you have a subscription, you don't necessarily know where those are, whereas in open access, you can find them. But I think it is a more superficial link. I think a lot of the open science efforts are focused on increasing access and making the scientific process more open and transparent, documenting more fully what was done and why. And people who are focused on those transparency reforms are, I think, in the same way, they're interested in transparency about the publishing business model. So where is the money going? Who's paying it? Who's profiting from it? So in that sense, I think that's the one sort of link, is trying to shine a light on how the model is extracting profits from the academic world rather than contributing to it in the commercial publishing sense. Yeah, I don't really see a tremendous number of other links. You know, I think one other link is that there are some journals in the open access world that, because they're not limited by page counts, they can select articles for different criteria. So if you're trying to publish in a Nature journal, they're going to select a criteria of, you know, novelty, theoretical importance, empirical rigor, lots of factors. But an open access journal in principle, and there are several that do this, PLOS One is an example, will publish an article if it is methodologically and statistically rigorous, empirically solid, whether or not it breaks brand new ground or has huge ramifications. Sometimes people will argue that that makes those journals less interesting to read, but because they can publish enough content, it means that you can have a more cumulative science. So in that way, the open access model can lead to, for example, replications being published more readily when they really couldn't in the past. There were very few journals that were publishing replications in psychology or other fields because, you know, they're not necessarily breaking new theoretical ground. Open access kind of provides a more of an outlet for that because they're not as limited both in page counts and by other criteria for acceptance. So I think that's the only other link between the open access and open science. But I don't think they have to be linked. You can do open science in subscription journals just as easily.
Well, there's emerging an interesting consensus. So let me play devil's advocate against this emerging consensus. I was looking at Frontier's website and I was just stunned how many downloads are being made in Africa and Latin America and so on. And I have to imagine that many universities, possibly most of them in, say, Africa, just, I don't know, I hope I'm not just speaking on the basis of my stupid stereotype, but many countries are financially very, very challenged. So probably many universities have no budget funding to subscribe to any journals in psychology, including, say, you know, APS flagship journal. I take it for granted that Psych Science is a flagship. You know, if you want to subscribe one, maybe that's one. However, probably that journal is not available. And instead, people who are eager to read science go to open access journals, including Frontier. That's my take of it. I may be misreading those numbers. However, my take is right. Really, open access model is literally doing great service in increasing accessibility. And I'm curious what Yoshi, you might know something about what's going on in Asian countries, or Ayşe. Well, Ayşe is from Turkey originally, and I wonder if you guys might have any insights on this issue.
I'm not sure if I can speak to my colleagues in some parts of Asia. So what I can say, though, is that certainly the open access journals enable some of the people, researchers and the university teachers, basically, most of them, and students to access some published work. So that's certainly increasing the accessibility. But whether or not that increases the scientific rigor of the research published is a different issue, right? So open access and the open science are two different sort of things. I kind of agree with Susan and Dan about that. But can I bring in a slightly different perspective on it, though? Certainly, we're talking about the access to science and also a quality, the quality of science, right? Those are the two main things that are the open access and the open science are concerned about. My take on that is that the actually scientific knowledge that we are trying to produce and disseminate and make available, from one perspective, it's a public goods, right? It's public goods, and how do we provide this public goods in a sustainable way? So it's not just the current generation of researchers and potential users of psychological knowledge that we are concerned about, but also the future, the carriers and the developers of that psychological knowledge. And how can we build capacities in all areas of the world so that the psychological science can advance and eventually, hopefully, be able to contribute to the global human society. Maybe I'm just dreaming too much, but that's what I think many of us hope to be able to achieve. Given that, it's a question of institutional design. How do we design this institution so that we can sustainably develop psychological science? And as part of it, surely we have to have good quality, and surely we have to have good access for everybody. Like some kid from Bangladesh may be able to access the top-notch research in psychology and may be inspired, and they may become the best psychologist in the world. Who knows, right? And so that's the sort of possibility we'd like to ensure by having open access. At the same time, who should be bearing the cost of that provision of the public goods? And would that be the libraries of the world, or would that be the producers of the knowledge, or the consumers of the knowledge, or somehow different combinations of these things have to be distributed across different players in this space? So that really is a question to me, and whether there is a good institutional design is something that we all have to think about. But one thing I would say, though, is that some areas of psychological knowledge, I think, it's better to be open access. And that area is actually directly tied to something like capacity building. So if the psychological knowledge that is made available openly to everybody is actually directly relevant for the capacity building, so that a kid in Bangladesh can pick it up and may be able to produce a great knowledge, well, that probably is a good thing. And just off the top of my head, perhaps a research method or some other sorts of things that enable people, capacity building, enable people to do the right research, good research, that might better be open access, but some other areas may not have to be. I'm throwing it out as a one thought.
Thank you so much. It's very, very interesting. This equity issue is very important and at the same time, very, very challenging. So for example, EU model, say models of private funders in Europe, their behaviors are extremely admirable, you know, just making lots of funds available to achieve social good. But actually, if you have access to that fund, that's great. You can qualify to become a producer of science. But, you know, if you are somewhere in Africa or somewhere in Michigan even, having no access to that funding, oh, I'm sorry. You can have free access to whatever I produce. You know, you are not, in effect, allowed to produce knowledge because you have no money or have no access to that money. So that whole scheme seems to contain, well, it's very admirable, no question about this, but at the same time, the system seem to be producing other layer of inequality in science, the divide of the world, poor and wealthy. And that seems very problematic and goes against the ideal of globalizing and internationalizing of the field. Before moving on, well, Susan first and then Dan second.
So here's a radical suggestion that I'm not advocating, but I've heard it advocated, which is throw out all the journals, throw out all the societies because they have to live on the journals, and just have everything be unposted and then reviewed spontaneously by whoever wants to review it. I personally think it's untenable because you wouldn't know what to read. Things wouldn't be vetted in the way that you could manage it. But I've heard it suggested when I said, you know, if all the journals are open access, all the little societies will go out of business. And the response was, so what?
Dan?
Yeah, so yeah, first, one response to that, you know, I agree. I don't think that's a workable model because what it would do is lead to famous people having their articles read and new researchers not, you know, disproportionately. I think it would benefit those who are already well known because their articles will all get read anyway, regardless of how they're published. But I was just going to respond to the broader question about equity, which is, I think, really the key issue for open access models. Most of the open access journals are building in waiver policies of some sort. And the question, of course, is how to fund those. So I've published open access a lot. I don't have grants at the moment. And I've never once had a problem getting a waiver if I didn't have funds to pay. And I've published almost entirely open access. You know, probably 80% of what I publish now is open access. I'm not the target for that. The target for that is people who really have universities that have no funding and other sorts of you know, more limited situations. But building a model that can accomplish that, that doesn't kind of exclude and lead to haves and have-nots in terms of being able to publish their own work, I think has really got to be the goal. Part of the reason I think people say scrap everything and, you know, just post it online is a reaction to the fact that the commercial publishers are extracting huge profits right now. So there is money there and they kick back to the societies, which keeps the societies afloat. But in essence, the societies are surviving on the commercial publishers taking the profits out of the research world. So the publishers are making a lot more money than they're giving back. And that suggests that there is money there in some form, if there's a way to redistribute it. So I think that's where that sentiment comes from. I agree. I don't think just relying only on preprints works, but you know, I think that's the sentiment behind that scrap everything idea.
Ajay, do you have any additional or new perspectives on the issue?
Yes. So we do discuss open access primarily in relation to the end users, so to the reader, but several of us have mentioned that the producers of knowledge should be in a position to be able to get their articles published without having to bearing the costs. And so we also would like that Bangladeshi student to be able to publish in those journals, not just to read the articles published in those journals. And I think we need to probably discuss the financial difficulties that come with open access publishing within the larger economy of knowledge creation. So for example, some universities, especially in the United Kingdom, heavily rely on international students from developing countries. So it's in Australia, for example, I think Yoshi, who pay very high fees, higher than local students, financed by their governments or their families. So the global north is making a lot of money from the global south. And those students contribute to knowledge production as PhD students, as master's students, and some of them stay in those countries to continue to contribute to these host societies' economies, right? So we have to, I think, discuss these issues within the larger context of who makes money from whom and who actually must be perhaps required to pay back, perhaps in the form of covering APC charges of those who cannot afford because they happen to be in a developing country and, you know, they don't have the funds to pay towards these costs. So why not expect these countries and institutions to contribute to open access initiatives as a way of paying back to those countries that practically finance part of their research, if we think about it in those terms. I also want to highlight that in the case of the United Kingdom, so I mentioned the research excellence framework, when they say papers that are going to be submitted for evaluation have to be open access, they also accept green access. So this is basically self-archived manuscripts, you know, the versions that are accepted by the journal. So they don't have to be published in open access journals. I also want to add that some of the European funders, such as Horizon 2020, so going back to the original question you asked, Shinobu, so open access is increasingly defined by these institutions as the practice of providing online access to scientific information, broadly defined. So by that, they don't just refer to peer-reviewed research articles being published in open access journals, but they also refer to research data. So scientific information, broadly speaking. So that's where they, you know, they think about this much more broadly than just open access publishing. You know, some of the conceptual issues that were discussed earlier, I agree, they have some overlap, but not necessarily huge. The issues that you referred to in terms of equity are hugely important and need to be discussed and thought about from both the end user's perspective and the producer's perspective.
I think this conversation is elucidating one very, very important issue when APS tried to internationalize itself. It was called American Psychological Society. Now it's Association for Psychological Science, and the intent is make it global, encompassing all humans, not only in North America, but also everywhere. This what Aisha described as North-South divide and barely really speak to the core of the issue. And well, surely I believe that APS need to think deeply about this, and maybe we can take advantage of this open access system or new system as a means to promote internationalization of psychological science. So now let me switch the gear to talk about our personal motivations. You know, if you're like me, you know, we do whatever we can to promote our careers and getting our new experiments published in best possible ways and so on. So any scientific system, publication systems, or any systems can work if the system corresponds to human motivation. System need to capitalize on our economic desires or our career desires or whatever to make it sustainable. So my question is this, well, how might open access system be weaved into the life and tasks of researchers as they navigate their research careers? That is, open access has become part of strategies that researchers use in publishing and promoting their work. Is this development good and healthy for psychological science, or are there any potentially negative side effects? And of course, well, as Dan pointed out, the same question can be raised for other models that is more traditional subscription-based model. So I think it's appropriate, Dan, if you can start off.
Sure. So I don't tend to think about these sorts of issues in terms of promotion of research, but in terms of visibility of research. So I think if you ask any scientist, they would say, yeah, I want as many people to be able to read my work if they're interested in it as they can. So other researchers or just policymakers, journalists, the public. That's perhaps even more critical in other fields like medicine, where patients want to be able to look at the research on their own situation, and if they can't access it, if they don't have a university library subscription, they're out of luck. But in psychology, it matters too. Being able to kind of access the work means that they are able to evaluate it for themselves. So I think from a self-publicity perspective, I mean, publishing open access just means more people have access. And if more people have access, that means more people are likely to read it. There are some suggestions that open access publications are cited at a higher rate than subscription-based publications, which again, isn't surprising. If you can't access it, you can't really read it to cite it. I mean, I imagine all of us have had the experience, even at our high-powered university libraries, of not being able to access an article in the literature. And how frustrating that is if you can't get access to something that you know exists, you want to read it, but it's not there, right? Or your library just doesn't happen to subscribe to that journal. Open access is just the way around that. So I don't really see any negative side effects of this. It also means that researchers at small schools or developing countries or countries that don't have large amounts of money can access the same literature that everybody else can. So as you pointed out earlier, Shinobu, that open access articles tend to be downloaded a ton, right? Yeah. Or maybe Susan was pointing that out. They're downloaded and viewed more often. So the readership is much higher than it would be for subscription journals. I tend to find that the papers I've published in subscription journals don't get cited as much as the papers I publish in open access, even though the open access journals might not be considered prestige journals. I think it's kind of leveling the playground by making everything, you know, more accessible, and the citations are going to be more based on what the work does and what it shows than where it was published.
Aisha?
Yeah, I also personally cannot really think of anything negative that can come with open access, you know, thinking about it as a principle. But as we have been discussing, how it is implemented and funded, that's, I think, the core of what we need to think about. And that can potentially lead to some unintended negative consequences, such as creating huge amount of pressure for scientists, you know, researchers, because they feel that they have to get grants and they have to, you know, get money for their PhD students and postdocs. And how are they going to do this? You know, like decreased well-being potentially. Specifically for psychology, I think open access will mean increasing diversity of our field by connecting researchers, you know, in different parts of the world who will have increasing access to scientific knowledge. And that's really crucial. We really have to continue to work on this. And it will also help us, you know, open our theories and methods to increase scrutiny. The more people read our papers, the more constructive feedback we can get. And you know, that would put us in a better position to improve our science and how we produce data and how we report it. Just as, you know, other open access practices, such as open access to data and so on, also publishing, thinking that a lot of people will read, puts us into a mindset of, as researchers, while we're working on our studies, it puts us into a mindset of applying more scrutiny to our own work, because I think it makes us take the perspective of the other. More people are going to read this. Not just my colleagues at my institution or in my country are going to read this, but people in developing countries will read it. So how should I communicate my research? What kinds of details do I need to talk about? How can I increase the replicability of my research? So I think it really contributes to, you know, improve theory of mind in a way, right? So, you know, what am I going to get out of this by other people, more people reading my research, by making it more accessible and so on. I think for psychology in general, and just like for other sciences, it should only be beneficial.
So I want to add, from my kind of gut feeling, sometimes I feel it's not quite fair when I have to donate my time to review other people's papers for free, so to speak. When I submit my paper, reviewers insult me, editor, I have to beg the editors to try to persuade them or her how great my work is, at least the flaw that he or she identify is only apparent and so on, all the effort get into it. And then when I'm lucky enough to get the paper accepted, now invoice comes in. This whole dynamic seems so capitalistic. Basically, you know, researchers end up being like a rat in Skinner's box, just the environment is set up in such a way that you cannot help but pressing the key. just to get the minimum amount of food. This kind of dynamic seems very, very problematic. But anyway, we can get back to it if there's any time. So let's move on to Susan now.
Well, I just want to go back to an issue that's come up sort of obliquely, but I am worried about the future of our scientific societies. You know, I'm involved with a number of them trying to figure out how to diversify the income stream in anticipation of the pressure for open access. And I think a lot of them are going to go under. And I think that would be tragic because, you know, the affinity groups that are built around shared interest, particularly more particular shared interests, you know, have conferences and journals and other services that enable you to keep up with the science. And I think it's going to be problematic.
That's another big issue. I'm serving on the executive board of APS, and I'm, in fact, the president for this year. And if we get rid of journal operations and conferences out of APS, nothing left. So really, there's a serious question of how to organize the society and how the finances may be managed within this scope. One radical suggestion is that, well, let's get rid of it. However, there's a lot offered by APS, at least I want to believe that. And we need a community of scientists to support each other. So getting rid of it is such a costly thing to do, seems to me. So I resonate with Susan. So Yoshi, you are the last person on this question.
Yes. Well, I think the personal side of it, I'm trying to collect my thought about, but I agree with both Susan and Shinobu about this, the necessity for sustaining a scientific community. And the open access journal, I don't know whether open access journal is a compatible with the a sustainable scientific community. Let me try to put two things together. As I was saying, I think who is going to bear the cost of the dissemination of a scientific knowledge is the question about the public goods and the provision of it. And the scientific community is, in a way, one way of solving that problem. By having a scientific community that is able to bear some cost of making that scientific knowledge available, that is one way of bearing the cost of that provision of public goods. And also, by having this scientific community, we can build the capacity and be able to shoulder some aspects of bringing the new talents into the scientific community so that this public goods can be produced into the future. If open access journal is used as part of that sustenance of the scientific community, that might be a useful part of it. So it could have a good role to play. But if all the journals are open access, I'm not quite sure if there can be a scientific community to sustain the provision of the public goods. My feeling is that there has to be some degree of a non-openness in order to do it. Maybe. It's really a very difficult question to solve.
Well, thank you very much. Right at this moment, the best strategy might be to try hybrid model to see how things might go. However, because of this pandemic, I'm sure financial situations of libraries will be getting very tight, which make the current publication models more difficult to sustain. Even today, I know for the fact that many Japanese universities have problems in subscribing to major psychology journals because of so high subscription costs. And Japan is not a particularly poor country. So this really illustrates the whole problem. And I think today we had very, very fruitful conversation. Obviously, intent is not to come up with the magic bullet to all the issues we are facing. However, given this current financial or societal situation, particularly financial problems that has been and will be caused by the pandemic, some change would be inevitable. I hope this panel was extremely useful in informing the members of our society, our colleagues, to think about where our society might go, might want to go. So I really appreciate your participation. Before closing, to conclude your thought, Dan, you are on the top. So would you like to start?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the main theme that we've heard a lot is how will we manage to finance this in such a way that we can increase diversity of authorship, sustain societies, and balance the sort of risks to societies against the costs involved. And it's not a simple problem. I'd like to point out that we're already paying for all of these journals, and we're also paying commercial publishers a lot of money. So the money is there, it's just not in the right places to sustain societies. And it's not clear how you move it around so that you can actually maintain the societies without having to rely on kickbacks from very high profit margins for commercial publishing. So the money is available in some form, and societies are going to have to figure out ways of tapping into it that don't necessarily depend on the subscription-based models as that changes. How's that going to work? I don't know. There are a lot of options for trying to kind of build university consortia, trying to figure out other ways of supporting journals, or potentially not having as many journals. Those are all different models of what our priorities are going to be for those societies and what role they're going to play. I also just kind of wanted to highlight a couple of things. So AMPS going open access, APS's methods communication journal going open access, I think does lead into a number of the factors that Yoshi was raising about access to resources, resources being skills or practices. And I think Aisha was also saying, if you make these sorts of method papers available very broadly, you can potentially improve research practices across the board for people who otherwise might not have access to those sorts of novel developments in the field. So that's one of the reasons I'm excited about that journal in particular going open access, is it can feed into the research practices across the entire discipline and for people who might not otherwise have access or be able to find those tools. The other thing I wanted to point out is that open access isn't the only kind of journal that charges authors. A number of subscription journals also charge authors article page charges, including PNAS and some of the other prestige journals that you can publish there. And it's a subscription model, so the publishers are making them some of the money from subscriptions, but they're also charging authors page charges for publishing in closed journals. So it's not that the publishing domain is really diverse. There are a lot of journals that are charging way too much because they're commercial publishers and they're profiting, and there are others that are scraping by and trying to build consortia. And I don't blame commercial publishers for trying to profit. That's what companies are supposed to do. But I think that's why we need to rethink what our relationship is to commercial publishing of the scientific literature and how we want to kind of structure that as societies.
Thank you. Hi, Shay.
I'll add two more things. One is that I think there's going to be a need for these discussions to be held across different countries and regions, including institutions that are not as well funded as the ones that we're affiliated with. So we really need to understand the difficulties that our colleagues are experiencing in different parts of the world. And these might not just be limited to not having access to journals. They might even include not having any functioning internet connection. So, you know, we really need to think broadly here and, you know, in relation to what that means for equality. The second point I'd like to bring up is that I think there has to be a change in attitudes and habits at different levels. And one of them also includes how universities will adjust to the fact that, for example, open access journals are low in impact factor, especially at the beginning. And it is still the case that we cut corners by just looking at the name of the journal to evaluate research articles. when we hire people, when we promote individuals at academic institutions and so on. So if we have a model where funders are, for example, pushing for open access publishing, but the universities are not actually coming on board with this, those kinds of tensions can potentially put especially early career researchers in great difficulties. So I think there has to be a kind of parallel action at different levels, trying to understand the challenges, the difficulties, and the opportunities, and hopefully come to a converged understanding of how we're going to walk this path all together. Thank you.
Thank you. Yoshi?
I don't have a lot of new things to add, but I just wanted to resonate the Dan's comments. I think the open access journals are a great way of disseminating or making information, scientific knowledge available. So if that can actually be used to build capacity for the production of better scientific knowledge, I think it is a good use of that mechanism. For that reason, I think having a method journal as a open access is a good mechanism. So I'd like to think of the open access journal as a way of a capacity building. If that can be used as a good mechanism for it, I think I'm all for it.
Thank you. Susan?
Well, I don't have much to add, except there's a business model we haven't discussed, which is endowing a journal. I've heard it suggested that for a mere $3 or $4 million, the income off that would keep certain journals going. So maybe the people who are running the enormously profitable publishing houses could donate money to sustain other journals.
With that, we conclude this panel. Thank you very much. I hope we have more opportunities like this in the future. I'm so grateful for your generous contribution to this panel. Thank you.